Welcome to the very first Digital Finance Analytics question and answer session. So just hello to a number of people who are on, Peter, Brett, a few others too. I'm not going to go through Craig. Interesting discussion about the demographics as well. Yes, it'll be quite a few different different people. So what I wanted to do is to take you through a bit of a discussion. We've already got loads and loads of questions prior, but obviously are going to focus predominantly on the questions that are coming up on the live chat, but we can pick up some of the other questions as we go through. I want to make quite clear, this is not financial advice today. This is just general discussion, opinion, but please don't take it as financial advice. I'm not qualified to give it. I'm not trying to give it. Please don't take it as such. That's really, really important. Otherwise, this isn't going to work. And just to say for those watching subsequent to tonight, this was recorded as at the 5th of June 2018. And things may have changed since then, because the stream will go up on YouTube after the chat tonight. And also, I'm going to post some editor highlights in a podcast as well. I get questions asked all the time about where I get my information from, because obviously I've got sources of information which other people may not have. Well, this is how I do it. So effectively, I run focus groups and customer surveys, and it's 52,000 households right the way through the year. And I also combine that with other surveys in the SME sector and also information from other places as well. But that all sits in my core market model. It's the core market model that gives me the insight that allows me to basically discuss issues and drill down into things a bit differently. So this is not effectively a set of data that's come from the banks. It's from consumers and households. So I come very strongly from the consumer end of the perspective rather than from the bank perspective. And then it goes into all sorts of reports, and you'll see some of those on the blog, and you'll see some on YouTube, and you'll see them also in other places too. So that's, in a way, that's my world, that's my research world. And I think it's quite important to understand that just as we get into this. We slice and dice the data differently, so we can look at it across different geographies, we can look at different segments and different property statuses, all those things. So that sort of Rubik's Cube is the way I think about the data that we run here. This is really the critical point. If you look at this, this is RBA data. If you look at this, you'll see that we've got consumption running a little slower than it was, but income is lower than consumption. And essentially, we're filling the gap with savings going down and borrowing more. So this is a story about households and their debt. It's a story about households and how they're managing to deal with all of that. And not surprisingly then, unemployment trends are pretty important. Unemployment is not going down. Do I use machine learning and AI in the models? Good question. I'm using a series of algorithms that I've developed over the years. The machine learning stuff is to do with the segmentation. And by the way, thank you. I should have said, please, if you put at What the World, you'll get my attention immediately in the chat stream. Yes, I agree, Trevor. Rather depressing graphs. Unfortunately, I spend a lot of my time being a bit gloomy about things. But, there's always a silver side to every cloudy, I suspect. Now, the thing about unemployment is that unemployment is probably not going to go down very much. And that's important, because essentially one of the critical things that have been worrying everybody is, when is wage growth going to rise? And the answer is, probably not very soon at all, because unemployment isn't actually falling below the magic 5%. Next one is just on mortgage rates. This is hot off the press. This is data released today. The full release will come out tomorrow. We measure mortgage stress each month. That's through our surveys. And mortgage stress is defined to those people who are not able to keep the cash flow coming in above the expenditure going out. And you'll see that it's ticked up again. It's 30.2% of all households now. That's close to 1 million households in mortgage stress. So they're people who are struggling to keep the ball in the air in terms of their income and expenditure. More on that tomorrow. There'll be a separate post in more detail. I agree. Yes, unemployment isn't a good indicator of household prosperity anymore. I absolutely agree with that. And of course, a lot of the thing about unemployment is that the definition of unemployment, yeah, actually, yes, we've already got somebody else coming. So, of course, unemployment is now defined quite narrowly. So you can be effectively working a few hours a week and still be, counted in the employment statistics and employed, when in fact you're not fully employed. And, of course, it's underemployment, which is a critical thing. Which is, of course, pretty important. Next thing is just on auction clearances. Now, you may have seen my video on auction clearances and how suspect those figures are, not least because what happens is that there's a long list of properties listed, and then when you actually go to see what happened on the Saturday, a smaller list was actually went to auction. So there's a gap there to start with. But even taking allowance for that, we're seeing auction clearances considerably down on a year ago. The latest data looks as though clearances will be around 40% this last week. What that means is that there is really no support for home price growth, and not surprisingly then we're seeing home prices fall. You'll see I've been talking a lot about that, and we're going to talk more about it. Yes, that's a good point about the mortgage stress one. Just go back to that. As if you look at it here, we're on a straight line path, other than that there was a detour post the GFC. And that's actually quite interesting, because that tells you something about the fact that there were some things going on where effectively lending went up, and that basically created the hole. And you could argue that this is when the lending standards went through the floor, and effectively more and more people were allowed to get bigger and bigger loans. Interest rates came down, but the stress is now back to a long trend path, unfortunately. And then home values still sliding. We're going to see more home price slides, no doubt about that. Hobart, I think, will probably follow suit in due course, but some of the other centres are already well underwater, and we're going to see, I think, more of that going forward. It's also worth noting that regional areas are actually not sliding as quickly. In fact, some are still growing, but I think that's sort of just a timing question. I don't think that regional areas can support home price growth when the main areas in and around Sydney. So, 40%, yes. I think you're right, Brian. 40% clearances are well down below. You know, they're often saying around 60% is a sort of a neutral setting for home prices. So that's one of the reasons why we think home prices will continue to slide. And this is just one last slide, and this is credit availability, right? So the weird thing is, the really weird thing is that even with the tightening in investor lending, so this is the dotted line here, this investor trend line is now sitting at around 2%. We've still got owner-occupied housing growth on a 12-month rolling basis sitting at around 8%. Now, when you think that incomes are growing at 2% and inflation is around 2%, what that tells you is that even with the current tightening, we still have more credit being doled out. And that means that household savings ratios are one thing, but it's the debt side of the equation which is the critical thing. And you'll see me talking a lot about debt. Debt is the real problem here, right? Because essentially it's credit availability and debt that determines the future outcomes of the economy. How do you measure credit availability, says Mr. Rogers? Well, this is based on two things. Firstly, we look at how many households have actually got a loan when they applied for it. So effectively, we look at the turndown rate. So it's sitting at about 40% now. It was around 5% a year ago. And secondly, if you look at the tightening in terms of the how much borrowing power that you've got, which essentially is about if you apply for a loan, what multiple of your income will you get? And that's come down as 2. So it's the combination of loans not being written and also availability of credit being tighter. Do you think the RBA would resort to helicopter money again or QE instead? I think it's quite likely that as the economy eases, and look, I have to say, I cannot see where we're going to see the level of growth that the Reserve Bank has been forecasting for quite some time. In the current numbers, everything that I see tells me something different. So let's assume that is the correct scenario. And let's assume also that there are international factors that perhaps may also depress momentum in the financial markets. it's quite likely that the Reserve Bank would move rates down and might even find some sort of QE or some other mechanism to try and fire the economy, because the Reserve Bank strategy has been for a number of years to use the housing sector to support the economy as the mining boom went away. And because the mining boom went away quite a bit sooner than perhaps some expected, nothing else was fully filling it, we've got this massive gap, which is why the Reserve Bank is very nervous about seeing interest rates go up or worrying about household debt. So, yeah, could do. Okay, another question coming up. New South Wales is 40% of GDP. If that is true, and New South Wales down, won't that be enough to drag the whole economy down? Yeah, in a way, it is it's a New South Wales and Victoria conundrum, right? Because that's where the bulk of properties are. That's also where the bulk of investment is. And to be honest, what happens in those two major states will more than swamp anything else in other states. Now, of course, we've had problems in Perth for quite a few years. South Australia is a bit sort of borderline at the moment. Queensland is also not looking flash. So effectively, we've been relying on New South Wales and Victoria. But of course, as home prices slide there, that will potentially have a drag effect, I think. Okay, Paul's asked, the US Fed is raising rates and reducing their balance sheets. Are you long-term bearish US dollar? Is the Aussie dollar a safe haven? Or could it, I can't read that, could it crash because of the property market? Okay, so there's no doubt that the US situation is actually quite concerning at the moment, because we are seeing considerable easing in terms of the the reversal of the Fed's money. In other words, the quantitative tightening that's happening, and we're seeing rates going up. I think there'll be another rate rise in June in the US, probably. We're seeing that having an impact in terms of the bond rates. So they're high. They're sitting at around 3%. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why the BBSW rate, the bank bill swap rate in Australia, has been moving up. That's the price of funding for the banks here. So the question really is, with the amount of debt in the US and with interest rates going up, will corporates and will the public sector in the US be able to service the debt? And the long-term scenario that I'm looking at is it's unlikely that they will without considerable pain. So at some point, I think that the momentum that's been created by the temporary tax cuts and some of the other things that have been going on will actually turn into a bit of a rout. When it does, then the question is the Aussie dollar a safe haven, or will it be actually dragged down earlier? And the answer is, my own view is, it will probably be dragged down a little earlier. Okay, so do you think the RBA keeps interest rates low regardless of what happens overseas? Will inflation go up and the cost of living go up? Well, we're already seeing the cost of living go up. One of the things to notice is that the fuel costs, for example, is at a four-year high. That came out today in the ACCC. We've already got considerable inflation that's not actually necessarily captured in the official figures, in my view. So if you look at the surveys that we see a lot of people struggling with a lot of bills, you know, fuel, electricity, all those things. So essentially, there's a lot of issues there. And what that means is that we're going to see probably inflation begin to rise. That means the Reserve Bank's really caught, right? Because on one hand, they don't want to allow interest rates to rise, because if they do, then we know that household debt's going to get severe. But on the other hand, if they drop rates, that's a sign of weakness. So they're really caught in the middle, I think. Okay, lots of questions. Let me just try and go back up here a bit. Okay. Why has the government RBA resorted to borrowing our way out of the GFC? Why was a credit being selected as a strategy for our economic growth? Ah, that's a really good question. So go back 7 or 8 years, right? The mining boom was there. Everything was looking pretty good. But everybody could see that the mining boom was essentially going to come off its tops. And the question then was, well, what else do you look to? And household consumption was the bet that the RBA made. And essentially, household consumption is driven predominantly from the housing sector. So a lot of the debt in Australia, particularly consumer debt, is to do with the housing sector. And in fact, public debt in Australia is, you know, it's growing a little bit, but it's not relatively high on an international basis. It's the private debt, it's the consumer debt, it's the household debt that's the critically high number. And we've got to the point now where I think we're all debted out from a household perspective. So that's the real critical question now. The Reserve Bank, I think, cut rates too low. I think the regulators let the control of the mortgage lending processes out of their sight. I think probably they were partially, you know, wanting to support growth, and therefore they wanted to support home prices. And by the way, if home prices rise and lending grows, that supports the GDP number. So you can see why, from a rational economic perspective, you might want to go there. But the fact is that we've now got the situation where debt is so high, where we've got households who are really struggling, and now interest rates are relatively low, and it's probable they're going to go up at some point. So that's why the debt mountain is really concerning. Okay, do you think Brisbane will have the same potential falls as expected for Sydney and Melbourne? The stranger asked me that question. Good question. Brisbane, of course, has not seen the same rises in home prices relative to Sydney and Melbourne. And in fact, I'm seeing higher levels of stress in some areas of Brisbane than even some areas of Sydney and Melbourne. A lot of the purchases that were being made in Brisbane, particularly in the CBD, were in the new apartments, and a lot of those were foreign investors or new first-time buyers. And in the last few months, I've seen a considerable decrease in the number of transactions from that sector of the market. First-time buyers are a bit more nervous. International buyers are stepping away a little bit. So we've got a big supply of property coming on in Brisbane, particularly in and around the CBD, and not enough people to buy them. So on that basis, my argument would be in and around the CBD, particularly for apartments, I expect those prices to slide. I don't think there'll be quite the same slide for homes, houses, particularly further out in and around Brisbane, because there is still some economic momentum there. So they may not correct as quickly or as fast as in Melbourne and Sydney. But over in the regional areas, we're already seeing significant concerns in a number of those. And in fact, some of my top 10 mortgage stressed areas are up in Queensland. So I think you've got to take it area by area and type of property by type of property. Okay. What's the likelihood of Australia seeing a Cyprus-style bail-in given recent emerging measure legislation? Okay. I knew we were going to get onto bail-in, and I just had that feeling. Okay, so let me just take you through the bail-in argument. Okay, so around the world, there has been an initiative to try and reduce the risk of governments having to bail out banks in a point of failure. You know, if you go back to 2008, that was really what happened. A lot of banks around the world got bailed out by government, particularly in the UK and also some in other places too. Now, that was an economically very costly thing for the country to deal with. So there's been an attempt to try and work alternative strategies, which basically says you need to have a pool of funds that you can call on if a bank fails, so that you can actually manage its decline in an orderly fashion and you can bail out depositors if you need. In other words, you can actually keep depositors' money safe. Now, there are two ways of doing that. One is to create a fund up front, and places like Germany have done that. So they're basically taking a levy from the banks and putting it into a fund to create protection for a future downturn. But the other way of doing it is to do nothing and essentially hope that things will be fine. That's what we're doing in Australia. So effectively, we now have a $250,000 per institution, per relationship, theoretical guarantee for deposits. But it's theoretical because it has to be activated by the government, and they would be able to do that in the case of a single bank if it went wrong. But of course, the chances are that if one bank started to fall over, multiple banks could be going the same way, and that would mean you could end up quite possibly with multiple banks all falling at the same time. Now, if you had multiple banks for failing at the same time, it starts moving into a different sphere, because essentially what that means is, if one bank falls over, the idea is that they'll guarantee up to 250k per pool of deposits, and then they'll pull money from that bank or from the industry to effectively pay for it. That's the model that's being used. But that's not going to work if multiple banks fail at the same time. So if that happens, then they have the ability to activate certainly some types of derivatives and some types of bonds that are hybrid bonds. So there are investors who are effectively taking the risk that they won't be activated. So that is definitely available to bail. And the question is, what about deposits? Because the legislation that came through earlier in the year made the a sort of any other instrument clause still there, right? And any other instrument could theoretically include deposits. Now, Wayne Byers has said, no, we're not going to, we were there to protect depositors, so there's no way that we would actually do that. But actually, deposits and depositors may not be the same thing, so you could actually argue that maybe deposits are slightly more at risk. And if you look in New Zealand, explicitly in New Zealand, their bail-in strategy is to effectively allow the bail-in of deposits, take those deposits, use them, and effectively pay the net amount back. So in New Zealand, it's explicit. In Australia, it is not explicit. It's all a bit hidden. And, you know, so far as we know, it will probably be all right, but there is a risk. So bail-in is, I think, a real potential risk. And, you know, money above 250K is not protected anyway. Money below 250K would only be protected if the government activated the guarantee. They haven't activated it because they haven't needed to. And the question is, what is the timing of activation vis-a-vis what APRA might do with bail-in? It's a big topic, quite risky, I think. Okay, let's have a look. So we never really experienced the GFC. We postponed the AU bubble by pumping up cheap credit, thus creating unrealistic living value prices to my asset classes. And that's Neil. Yes, Neil, that's exactly what happened. So effectively, we didn't. We got away with the GFC. And you know, whatever they may say, this wasn't because we actually had really, really good regulators and really good policies. We were lucky. And we were lucky partly because of China and because China did a big stimulation around the time of the GFC, and that flowed through to Australia, and we had the mining boom. So that's how we got through. But we never really dealt with the underlying issues that we actually had in the economy. And we frittered away 5 or 6 years of considerable wealth creation. You know, under some governments, there were tax cuts and there were all sorts of things given away pre-GFC. And then, of course, post-GFC, there was a big stimulus that was also put in. I think the first one was right. I think the second one probably wasn't. So we've basically squandered the opportunity that we had to lay the foundation for long-term sustainable economic growth. And since then, we've been battling uphill against this conundrum about households seem to be supporting the economy. Households is effectively, by asset prices, it's house prices and stock prices. Quantitative easing around the world has pumped up all types of assets. And that's why people sometimes talk about the everything bubble. In other words, everything is really lifted. And those values are, you know, if I take home prices, they're about 40% over what the long-term values should be based on fundamentals. So that's things like loan-to-income and those sorts of things. So assets are considerably overvalued at the moment. Then the question is, well, if they're overvalued, what do you do about that? Do you effectively, you know, hope that income growth starts to rise? And as it does start to rise, then potentially we may be able to deal with some of the debt servicing. But if incomes don't rise, and if debts continue to rise, you know, I told you that slide earlier on, 8% growth in unoccupied lending still at the moment, we've still got too much debt. And I think we've got to the point now where we've got so much debt in the system that we really are unable to see how we can deal with that. Okay. Really like your work. What's your opinion on bank stability? UBS seems to think Westpac is worst placed. What's your view? And which bank do you think is best worst placed? It's hard to know precisely where the banks are placed because the information that they provide is relatively high level. And you've got to ask whether they actually know enough about their data. So if you assume that we've got liar loans in the system, which I agree with UBS, my data is has always shown higher debt to income ratios and lower incomes relative to the data that I see coming back from the banks. So I think that we're in the situation where we have risks potentially of the loan portfolios being less strong than we might think. Now, we won't necessarily know how bad they are until incomes rise, or you know, which would help to pay off debt, or if defaults start to rise. And so I'll be looking for those early warning signs of debt effectively continuing to translate to defaults. Now, here's an interesting thing. If you look at the current default rates across Australia, they are actually rising slightly from a few months ago. And that's particularly true in Western Australia, but it's also true in New South Wales. Now, Wayne Byres 3 or 4 months ago made a speech when he said, with interest rates at these low levels, I would expect defaults to be lower than they are. That's what he said. And I agree with him. They should be lower than they are. And whilst they're low by historical standards, they are actually not as low as they should be. And then if you overlay my mortgage stress modelling, which effectively tells me about what sensitivities there are to future interest rate rises or to cost of living rise, we have a bunch of households who are actually potentially exposed. Now, going back to Westpac, have they been really clever in picking particular types of borrowers with higher than average incomes and lower risk profiles? They may be. But I think there's also as a bigger chance that they probably haven't. And they are the bank, they, you know, Westpac is the bank who's still lending the strongest at the moment. So potentially, I think they may have more issues in their portfolios than they think. Are they the most risky bank? Hard to tell. But they are certainly the most exposed to the investor sector. And that's the final point I wanted to make on this one. Investors in a downturn are 4 times as likely to default compared with unoccupied borrowers. That's data from the Bank of England in the UK. So you'd think that investors, if they got into difficulty, would essentially sell. And we're already seeing that. So that we're seeing more people selling in Sydney, particularly, but also now Melbourne, investors who are selling. And that means that we're going to see potentially some negative impact on portfolios. So the bank with the highest investor portfolio, the bank with the highest ratio of interest-only loans potentially may be most exposed. Okay. Multiple banks falling over. Should we call this the Australian contagion, a la Dutch disease? Yep. The issue is that all the stress testing that's done in Australia is done at an individual bank level. Now, APRA writes quite vociferously about its stress testing, and the banks talk about their stress testing. But each bank is stress tested in isolation, right? The question is, what happens if you have 2 or 3 or 4 banks all under pressure at the same time? Because then you've got market pressures that may mean you can't raise more funds when you want to at prices that you need to. Or you may find that effectively the level of support funding that's available the RBA, for example, is taken up and you know there isn't enough to go around. So we don't have a systemic structured view of how the banking system in its entirety would work under pressure. Now that's, I think, a big gap. And I think that the regulators, and that's the Reserve Bank and APRA, have to take responsibility for that. Because to my mind, whilst individual bank stress testing is interesting, and by the way, they don't publish results here, whereas they do, in, for example, in the US, you can actually see each bank in the US and where they are on the stress scale. None of that's available in Australia. But beyond that, structural testing of the entire system is what we need, and I don't think we do enough of that. Okay. Do you ever speak with or collaborate with Australian economist Steve Keane? Well, yeah, Steve Keane and I have several conversations over the years, when he was in Australia. And in fact, before he took his walk to Kosciuszko, because, of course, he predicted that home prices would fall. And, so we have a little bit of exchange of views over the years. Of course, he's now overseas in the UK. He actually follows me on Twitter and occasionally, tweets some replies. We fundamentally agree on one really big platform, and that is that it's credit that drives home prices, You know, you can talk about migration and immigration, you can talk about supply and demand and all those other things, but it's ultimately credit. I've done a lot of modelling on this, Steve's done a lot of modelling on this, we both agree. Credit is the critical driver. If you allow credit to grow, then effectively you can lift house price assets. And there is no limit on the amount of credit that is available. What I mean by that is that banks can magic credit out of thin air. They don't need deposits. And this is a fundamentally important point, and it's a very different philosophy around economics, right? Most of the mainstream bankers and regulators say deposits lead, loans follow. And in fact, loans aren't important because effectively for every loan, there's an offsetting asset, and therefore they cancel each other out. Now, that's been mainstream policy for many years, but it's not right. What is true is that banks have the ability to create magic, if you like, loans out of nothing. So if you want a loan, if you're able to repay, the banks can create it. They may actually access the capital markets to get the funds to give you the loan. They might use deposits, but they don't need deposits. So deposits don't come first. Deposits follow, right? It's a product of bank creating money. This is quite a new theory. It was generated a few years ago in the UK. The Bank of England published a paper. Even places like Deutsche Bank have been talking about this more recently. So this is the different philosophy. Now, if you buy that, if you accept the argument that it is fundamentally about credit and credit availability, then the other is true. As credit availability is curtailed, then asset prices slide. And that's what we're seeing now. That's why I showed you the slide earlier on about the tightening of credit and lending, because essentially availability of credit and the tightening of credit means home prices will slide. So Steve and I agree on that. Now, what you do beyond that is the interesting question. Right now, I know Steve has argued for some sort of debt jubilee. In other words, he's arguing that the debt is now to the point where it can never be solved through normal course of people paying off, because it'll be an intergenerational debt problem, you know, down the generations. And I agree with him that we've got too much debt. If you're a student, you've got debt. If you've bought a house, you've got debt. Debt was, if you like, the only way to go. But we've now got to the point where we've got so much debt in the system that we're all debted out. Now, you know, it's not really fair for those people who've managed to manage that debt and pay it down, because, of course, you know, they've done it the hard yards. But we've got to the point now where we've got to the point where debt is really just way, way too much. So the question is, can you manage it out, you know, through normal course of events, or do you need essentially to find abnormal strategies to deal with it? And those could be things like a jubilee. It could be things like the Chicago plan, which is effectively where you get rid of debt, you change the fundamental equation in terms of asset prices. There's a sort of a workout plan. I promise that one day I'll do the video on how that works in practice, but I can't talk about the Chicago plan in detail now. The other thing that's worth thinking about is things like Glass-Steagall. So, you know, the Glass-Steagall separation of trading activities and speculative activities in the bank from its core meat and potatoes, borrowing and deposits, is a way of controlling the size and shape of the bank. So Glass-Steagall is also another factor in here. So going back to Steve Keen, we do see things quite similarly in many ways. I think there are some interesting arguments that he puts up there. The problem is, of course, that Steve's been saying there's going to be a crash for years and years and years, and there hasn't been until now. I guess if you say it long enough, it ultimately becomes true. Yes, and as Big Sinner Risk Ninja said, yes, watch my videos on on this. I've spoken at length on my videos about why credit is so critical. Steve Keen predicted the GFC. Yes, he did. Please send some coffee for Michael. Well, I've got some water here. I noticed, actually, I don't know whether you noticed this, some of the other people who stream on YouTube from Australia, Aussies, all have beer. I'm afraid that if I start drinking beer, I just fall asleep, so that ain't going to work. Okay. What are your thoughts on the upcoming Swiss plebiscite for sovereign money being used for credit creation versus commercial credit creation? Will this solve the business cycle? Okay, thanks, BP. Very interesting. Yeah, I think the vote's any day now, unless it's been postponed again. So there is a vote. So in Switzerland, if enough people sign a a petition, they have to take it about vote. And what they're asking to do is to limit banks' ability to lend to the amount of deposits they have. So if you go back in history, that's how banks worked, right? So basically banks took deposits from people who had funds and then lent those on. So there was a one-to-one match between deposits and loans. And that's how banks originally worked. And that meant that there was some limit and some control because the deposits and the loans were sort of linked. And then we got the sort of the fractional banking, as it's called, where effectively you start creating multiple ratios of deposits to loans. So typically the Basel rules, you know, was 8% ratio, which means you could effectively multiply the amount of lending you can make relative to the deposits you can have. And then, of course, the banks were allowed to then speculate on that. They could use securitization, they could use other mechanisms to essentially bolster up their balance sheet. And if you look today, most banks, if you look at the amount of capital they have relative to the amount of lending that they have, it's about 4% of shareholder funds relative to the loan books they have. What that means is they're highly leveraged, right? Which is why they're so profitable. That's why we've got some of those profitable banks in the world. It's nothing to do with efficiency or great management. It's all to do with these weird ratios. So the Basel Committee, which is the global, the banker's banker effectively, set all this up. And though these ratios are all built on this idea of multiplication from deposits. So what Swiss is doing is saying, no, let's take a vote on whether in fact we should bring that back together. And by the way, Iceland, after the crash in 2008, did a big review and they made the same recommendation that essentially they should limit the size of lending to the amount of deposits. Now think about the implications for that. What would happen if we moved to that? Well, firstly, the amount of loans available would drop dramatically. And on my argument that loans and credit drives property prices, you'd see property prices slide considerably. But the other side of it is, Swiss is saying, we should focus on credit availability for productive business rather than home lending. And I agree with them on that, because if you look carefully at what's happened in the last few years, is we've had massive growth in mortgages, and they are the lowest risk rated type of assets. So the banks are very happy to do that. But it's much harder if you're a business to get the capital that you need to invest. And in fact, business investment is still way below owner occupied, as I showed you in that earlier slide. So what that tells me is that effectively, currently, the playing field is completely tilted away business lending. Now, I think we have to change that. And I've always argued that the way to do that would be to address the ratios, in other words, the risk ratios between business lending and mortgage lending, or something like what Swiss is talking about, or indeed Chicago Plan, where you effectively say, no, we're going to redesign the banking system to be able to deal with what banks should be for, which is to support productive commercial investment to grow things, rather than just artificially inflate home prices. And what we've had over the last few years is a complete inflation of home prices, personal balance sheets. You know, everyone says, oh, I'm feeling really rich because my house is on paper worth twice as what it was. Well, yeah, maybe, but if you come to sell it in a downturn, maybe it isn't as worth as much as you perhaps thought. So all of those things are in the mix there. So I think there's a really strong case for moving to a different way of thinking about the relationship between deposits and loans. And there are various structural ways, so I'll be interested to see what happens with the Swiss vote in a little while. I'll report on it when it comes through. Oops, I've skipped over you. Yes, I probably skipped over a few questions. I've got so many questions here in the stream. Hang on, let's go back. What do you think about cross-collateralized mortgages? Is this specific to Australia, or do other countries have them as well? Yeah. The answer is we have a particular ability to do that here. In other words, you basically take the funds out of one property and then effectively use the equity out of that to the next one, to the next one, to the next one. It's like a stack of cards, right? So effectively each is cross-leveraged on the next. That is something which is not allowed in some other countries, and it certainly blows up the debt burden here. It's interesting, if you look at the investors in my surveys, there are a lot of property investors who have 5, 6, 7, 8 properties, all cross-leveraged off each other, all on interest-only loans, and all sitting pretty when interest rates were really low and when prices were going up. Now, of course, the question happens, what happens if prices start to slide? Because then, of course, it all turns negative. At the time that the regulators have pressed on the banks to tighten lending criteria for interest-only loans, and, of course, now a lot of them can't get a reset to another interest-only loan. So we've got the situation where this cross-collateralized thing is essentially driving a whole bunch of outcomes that perhaps we wouldn't want to see. Okay, let's have a look. Do you see similarities with Canada's property downturn, also fueled by too much debt? We seem to be following similar trajectory to them, albeit a few months behind. Trafford has put that out there. Thank you very much. Yes, there's some interesting parallels, and I do report on Canada on my blogs from time to time, and particularly in the Property Imperative Weekly, which is my sort of summary, because I do think there's some interesting parallels there. They've had very high debt. They've had asset bubbles. They've also got banks with very high ratios of debt. And in many ways, I think we are following them and they're following us. There are some few differences in the way that the Canadian market works, particularly in some of the big urban centres. I think there is still probably some demand there, particularly for units. But they've also had an international surge of investors as well, particularly from China and other places too. So there are some very strong parallels. And I do watch Canada and indeed the UK as analogous markets to what's happening here. And I think you're right insofar that we are following. Yep, we are following what's happening there. Okay, another one from Yusuf. If interest rates go up and costs of lending go up, will rents go up by the by the way, I like your shit. Thank you. Yes. Okay. No. The thing about rents is that rents are much more connected to wages than the cost of property. If you look at it over the long-term trends, rental costs and the price of rent is much more correlated. So even if rates went up and costs of property went up, it's unlikely that rents will follow unless incomes start to rise. And that's simply a fundamental economic problem that many people who are renting are on restricted incomes. And I model rental stress as well as owner-occupied mortgage stress. And around 60% of households are in rental stress today, even with the current low interest rates. So I think it's very unlikely that we're going to see rents rise anytime soon. Okay. Lewis Cullen. Thoughts on the omission of credit money banking from mainstream economics? The fact it's been ignored and even laughed at. Yes, Lewis, you're right. Here's the thing. Many economists believe that because, a credit and a debit cancel each other out, it doesn't matter, right? That's the fundamental economic premise that they operate on. And it's completely wrong, as I've argued earlier on. And there is a real lack of proper understanding of what goes on inside the banking structures. Now, there are some economists who really understand high-level modelling and, how the dynamics of the economy work, supply and demand, all those sorts of things. And then there are bankers who actually understand how banks work to an extent. But that cross-pollinization of the two is an area that really is underrepresented. I guess one of the things I've tried to do in the work here on the blog and on YouTube is to try and show the interrelationship between the economic world and the banking world. And it's really important that we put these things back together. So I believe that there's a real need to really look at this differently. And that's why I'm arguing for a different economic basis and philosophy, which defines banking differently, because I think the current model is actually incorrect. Okay, Rabusculus. Very interested to hear your thoughts on China's health. Some people are talking massive debt bomb, but they seem to be controlling it very well. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, if you look at the trends in China, the debt is going up considerably. But they're also doing a lot of good things as well. They've sort of loosened a few of the controls in some of the banks, and they've tightened them here and tightened them there. then the question is, well, how much is the data is correct? Do we know? Well, we don't really know. We are reliant on the way that they present the data, and therefore, you know, you could be right, could be wrong. But I think net-net, my reading on China is they're actually doing a pretty damn good job of migrating the economy away from, you know, just very basic manufacturing to creating value and getting a consuming economy going in China. And that could potentially save them. I guess the trade wars thing is there in the background, and that could have a considerable impact too. But I do think they are not doing too badly at the moment. And, you know, the debt ratio is much higher than it was. On an international basis, they're one of the ones to watch. But I'm not overly concerned in the short term, at least. Okay. Let's see. The big bank will not go bankrupt as they are protected by the government. They can bail in depositors' funds if they need. Well, I think we discussed it earlier on. That's exactly right. The banks are in a very protected position, right? And one of the reasons why the banks' ratings are still pretty high is that they are effectively seen to be supported by the government. And there's that reserve fund that the RBA can tap into. And basically, the banks are too big to fail. That's the theory that the market has at the moment. And that's why they're given the ratings that they are. And that's why there are investors around the world still looking at the Australian banks, despite the fact that their share prices are down an average, say, 20% from their peaks. So the banks are very large. They're so large that if one were to fail, that would have significant consequences. So that the government and the regulators will do whatever they need to do to try and protect the banking system and to protect the banks. So they are too big to fail. That's why my argument is it's time to break the banks into smaller pieces. And the Royal Commission, of course, discussed this in terms of, is it right to have, you know, mortgage brokers and financial advisors in the same firms as the people who manufacture those products? The answer is no. You'd split them apart. Is it right to have mortgage lending and wealth management and insurance and all the other verticals in the same organization under the same umbrella? My own view is it's very hard to justify because it's those businesses are quite unique and different. A lot of people have tried and failed to manage well across those pillars. So I think there's a very strong and compelling argument for breaking the banks into smaller pieces. And then that would stop them being too big to fail. And that would actually reduce the risk of the government having to bail them out or even deposits being required. But that's a very significant and radical move from where we currently are, where we have four very large players who effectively are guaranteed indirectly by the government. Okay, Martin, are you avoiding my question? Is this time really different? Sorry, Big Sinner Ninja. No, I'm not avoiding your question. I've got so many. I have a lot. Yes, I do believe it's different this time. The reason I believe it's different this time is because of the credit tightening that's going on, right? The last couple of times we had, you know, small amounts of credit tightening, but then things got back to normal. I think this time credit tightening is happening. I've told you about the, you know, the 35% drop in mortgage power, the 40% of loans that are actually not being approved currently. Those are different things. And that's why I believe that we will see home price kings drift down, that effectively we will see mortgage growth going to reverse. And I'm not convinced that even an occupied mortgage lending will continue. So, yeah, I think it is different this time. To say nothing of the international perspective, right? So we've got the questions about what's going on in the US, particularly there, as we talked about earlier on, in terms of potentially rates rising in the US and the debt bomb there. We've got the geopolitical issues with regard to trade, and there's a bunch of issues that are out there. So I think, you know, if you've followed my four scenarios, and scenarios is a way that I try and explain how different things may work, this shows me a little bit about, you know, where we are. And scenario four, which is my Armageddon scenario, is still the one that I think is a little bit over the hill, but we're in scenario two and scenario three at the moment. So, yes, it is different. Do you, any jail sentence will be handed out? This is from Donna. Do you think any jail sentence will be handed out to anyone involved in the financial fraud that's been uncovered? I think it's a bit unlikely. I mean, the ANZ and Citigroup and Deutsche Bank thing that was announced yesterday and again today is criminal proceedings, and that's cartel behaviour. You might see something there. But in terms of the broader you know, massively bad lending over a long, long time, people being cajoled into getting loans they shouldn't have. I'm of the view that it's unlikely. I'm honest. You know, if you go back to the GFC and, you know, the US, there's almost nobody there jailed for all the things that happened then. So, yeah, I think it's probably unlikely. Needs to be, but, yeah. Now, somebody, 7555TX, the private debt in Australia is higher than that of Canada. You're correct about that. It is, yes, indeed. That's why I continue to say that there's nowhere else in the world, pretty much, maybe other than a few Scandinavian countries that are set differently, where the debt ratios are so high and it's looking pretty uncomfortable. Okay. You've been exploring, this is from Gav240Z, you've been exploring Bitcoin and cryptographs. Do you see a collapse in the faith of fiat currency and a flight to cryptos in the future? Will money be outside the control of banks eventually? Yeah, it's interesting that the bottom line is this. There is a battle going on at the moment as to whether crypto will be inside or outside the banking system. So I did a post quite recently about central banks and their idea of digital currencies within central banks. So effectively what they're trying to do is to put inside digital currencies under the same sort of frameworks and controls as the current currencies. And there's another battle where effectively you've got crypto outside, you know, the Bitcoins and the distributed ledger alternatives. And we're going to see a big tussle between those two. The problem is with the distributed ledger cryptos is that there are still some weird things going on in the exchanges and it's quite speculative. With regard to the central bank digital currencies, we're going to see a lot of more about that. And I think that's probably going to be the way. I expect regulation to be forced in that will actually put crypto within the control of the central banks, because I don't think that they can countenance the idea of not being there. So the question then is, can you create cryptos outside of that in a different structure other than, say, Bitcoin and you know, the other ones at the moment that deal with some of the other risks that are there? And it's not real money at the moment. You know, if you take the definition of money, and I did a video on this, you can see that there are some things where Bitcoin really doesn't stand up very well. So we're in for a tussle. My own view is, though, that the future, ultimately the future, will be digital money one way or the other. And there are all sorts of reasons why I think that'll be the case. And again, I did a post on that some time ago. But it's going to be a long, interesting game. 755TX, is this your first live stream? It is for DFA, yes. Generally, I'm on the equipment side doing it stuff for other people, which is why I've got the gear sort of set up the way I have. But this is the first time I've done one for DFA. And I guess it'd be interesting to see whether you think this is something that merits repeating. Potentially happy to do it more frequently. Might even do the occasional live stream rather than recording and then posting, because that's actually quicker to do. So if this is successful, and this is an experiment to see whether I could do it and, you know, whether it would work, and it sort of seems to be working, then yeah, we'll perhaps do some more. But now this is the first one. Okay, Jan says, what do you think will happen to extremely overpriced regional markets like Byron Bay and the overall market when the overall market goes pear-shaped? I think that regional markets are a bit on their own, but ultimately they are going to be impacted by the broader economic context that we're in. I've seen some regional markets move. I think, you know, one or two, like Geelong, has been up significantly in recent times. But it's hard for me to see why that would continue if the major markets fell and continue to fall. So my own view is that the regional markets are likely to slide down, not, you know, immediately, but over the medium term. They haven't grown up as far, of course. So if you take the Sydney market, you know, it's well over 40% valued. If you look at some of the regional markets, probably there is probably only 20% overvalued. So you might argue that prices won't come back as far. But I think the general trajectory will still be the same as in the main centres. I just don't think that there's enough momentum in the regional centres on their own to support the broader economy. Okay. Yes, thanks, yes. There's so many conversations going on here. It's that if you tag at Walk the World, you're more likely to get my attention. If Aussie banks go down, so does our super. Empty nesters want good retirement. They have seen a few cycles, expect higher property stock volumes. Yeah. The superannuation system, it really isn't fit for purpose at the moment. I think the Productivity Commission showed us that. And, you know, there are many, many people who are paying way too many fees and not getting the returns they want. But, of course, a lot of the superannuation is owned by the major banks, right, as part of their retail funds. So if the Productivity Commission recommendation is made good, which is that there's a list of top 10 funds, the higher performing funds are actually the ones that people can pick from, they wouldn't be retail funds, they'd be industry funds. So maybe there'd be some changing of the guard there. But the fact is, a lot of superannuation is actually in property through funds and in banks through funds. So we want to be careful what we wish for here, because effectively if the banking system, you know, begins to sort of collapse, it's going to really take superannuation with it. So I think that's a really good point made there. If banks are creating money out of thin air, why can't they wipe it off as easily as they create it? Good question. It's all numbers. It's all numbers. There's a legal issue, right? So in Australia, if you have a loan, you have it's on a full recourse basis. And even if you hand the property back, you still got the loan. In some other countries, it's not the same. So that full recourse means that basically you'll be hunted down until you pay it off. And that's the problem. So we've inflated asset prices. We've written huge loans, and we've got people now walking with massive loan burdens on their heads. And we've got a structure, an economic structure and a legal structure that basically makes sure that people are forced to pay it off. That's the reality. And therefore, it's not as simple as clicking your fingers. But the Chicago plan is a way of dealing with that, because effectively what the Chicago plan is saying, because it's artificial, in other words, we've inflated asset prices and we've inflated loan, we'll reset both and then effectively start again. That's what the Chicago plan is all about. Well, we're just over the hour. Still more questions coming through. I don't know who Mark Blythe is. Where does what Mike Blythe stand you in the... I know, you'll have to tell me what that is. I don't know that. Have you watched documentary Princes of the Yen by Professor Werner, Germany? If so, do you see parallels with the credit tightening in these examples? Yeah, there's some parallels, I think. You're right. Martin, is not the Australian banks too big to save? Will the banks be nationalised or bail out at least two banks? Well, I suspect we'll muddle on. So my theory of, you know, my theory is, until things get really bad, we'll muddle on. We'll muddle on with very large banks. I suspect that the Royal Commission recommendations, which will be quite, I think, far-reaching, will be implemented very, 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 very slowly, and just in time to make sure that nothing happens prior to the election, because, of course, the last thing you want are falling home prices prior to an election. So I would not be surprised to see, you know, a very slowly, slowly, slowly. And of course, Scott Morrison pretty much said as much on 2GB the other week. You know, take our time, make sure you get it right. We don't want to scare the horses, you know, all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, it's going to be a long, slow. Unless we get an external disruption, and I go back to my scenario four, if we do get an external disruption, we have almost no shots left in the locker here. We, not like last time where we had, you know, money in the bank. We don't have money in the bank now. We've got high household debt. We've got increasing government debt. So we don't have a whole lot of protection if we get a global tsunami coming and hitting us. And that's what I'm concerned about, because effectively, I've said later on, we squittered away over a 5 to 8 year period the ability to be able to save for a rainy day. If you compare the Scandinavian countries who got massive income from oil, they put it away into national funds to be able to protect them in a downturn. We haven't got that. So, yeah, we've definitely got some risks. Okay. I won't read out what somebody said about Scott Morrison, but, yeah, interesting. What effect would the Chicago plan have on individuals? How much magic will any government attempt to retain asset value? Yeah, interesting question. there are different ways the Chicago Plan can work out. And in fact, if you want to find out more on how the Chicago Plan works, do a search on YouTube. There's a couple of really good videos that's been done quite recently explaining the mechanisms. Because basically what you do is you basically do a bit of reset. You provide people with sufficient to be able to repay the loans from this reset. You reset values and you basically create a new lending environment that effectively drives lending towards productive outcomes. And it stops boom and bust cycles. That's the whole point, right? We've had boom and bust driven by these banking cycles for years now. And this is a way of trying to deal with the boom and bust cycle. And interestingly, the Chicago Plan is not new, okay? It was actually spoken about in the 1930s. Didn't get up then, but actually there's a lot of very powerful thinkers behind it, and I think it's worth looking at. Okay, question. Do I prefer tea or coffee? Tea, of course. I'm British. What do you expect? Deutsche Bank. Yes, various people ask you about Deutsche Bank. Yeah, Deutsche Bank is big and has significant issues and is probably one of the more exposed organizations globally. Watch with interest, I think, is what I'd say there. Okay. The government has taken a property version of the Hippocratic Oath. Do no harm to our precious property. Yeah. I think that's a really interesting point, because my theory is this. We've got a government at the moment who is more concerned about maintaining its own momentum and its own footprint and its own capability than actually benefiting the broader society and economy. And in a way, the banks and the government are on the same side of the equation, unfortunately. And sometimes I think that we need to stand back and think harder about what is good for, you know, society and for individuals. My belief has always been that the economy is there to support society and individuals, rather than just milk them. Okay, interesting question. How to short the housing market? Yeah, hard to do in Australia. Interesting, I've had spoken at some length to a whole bunch of people, investment bankers and other people overseas who are trying to find ways to short the housing market in Australia. It's hard to do. You can look at property companies, but, you know, that's an indirect. Some are even thinking the banks are a way of shorting the housing market, because of the fact that the banks, 60% of their loans are mortgages, and they also lend to the construction sector as well, another 15%. So they're sort of 75% property. So that may be a way to think about it. Jason's saying, I'm a bit shocked that the cash rate was left on hold today. What are the major factors? Well, basically, the RBA's backed into a corner. They can't take rates up because people will get into such terrible debt burden if they do. If they take rates down, it will just fire the property market again. So they're hoping upon hope that if by doing nothing for long enough, wages will magically start to rise. And of course, in the forward estimates and in the economic plan, it's looking at 3% plus for income growth. I can't see where that's going to come from. I just can't see it, as I discussed earlier. Okay, well, we're 9:08. I'm going to just go on until about 9:15, I think, and then I'm going to pull the pin, because I need another drink. Do let me know what you think about all of this, and particularly whether you like the format and whether you like the idea of live Q&A. I had a whole bunch of questions that I got asked previously via the web, through my blog and other places, and frankly, I haven't addressed any of them. What I'll do there is either do another post later, or I might do an offline one. And if you've got more questions, I'm happy to incorporate them as well. We've got 95 people watching, which is not bad. Ahmed says, I'm doing a great job. Thank you. Yeah. and Matt says, I'm drinking a scotch watching this. They're very good. Gold standard. Yeah, could be. Interesting question, of course. Did you know that gold, in 1959, there was a law brought in that basically says the government can actually grab all the gold if they wanted to at a set price? True. Still on the books. Cameron says, great show. Thank you very much. Love the format. Perhaps include live polls and interesting topics. Yeah, yeah, yeah. 178 watching, not 95. No, that's because mine is frozen. So there you go. Yes, you're right. Rate hike probably in the US in June. I expect a rate hike. I think Yeah, the cost of money is going up permanently. We're already seeing that. If you look at the 10-year yield, it's pretty interesting. You know, the US funding rates are going up. That's translating into higher interbank costs, higher BBSW costs. You have about 22, 23 basis points off the lows for Australian banks. And that's enough to force them potentially to put mortgage rates up here. Jeremy says, Martin, do you follow any financial forecasters? I sort of read a few, but frankly, I paddle my own canoe. I sort of like doing it from a point of view of households and a little bit of a view as to, you know, what I'm seeing from the front line, because I'm tending to be ahead of the curve. So my surveys come in every week, so I'm already ahead of the curve. And then I overlay the economic stuff and run my own models and things. But I do read a few other people. No, I don't have any crypto, Big Sinner asks. And DV says it takes time for higher credit costs to affect property here. Yeah, that's true. The fact is, credit availability is already way down, so people aren't getting the loans. Investors are voting with their feet. You know, investor credit growth is almost nowhere. But it's the higher costs of credit over time, and I run sensitivities in my models on that. And there's about 23% of households who have no wriggle room. In other words, if rents went up even 25 basis points, they'd have a real problem, 0.25%. There's about another 8 or 9% that will be hit. 50 basis points, 1%, 2%, right? If you went up 2%, which is still well below the long-term average, we'd be around 35% of households not being able to make those mortgage repayments. It's pretty, pretty bad. Prices have already dropped 20 to 25%. People, yeah, it varies, of course. Okay, another one. In terms of demographics, is Gen Y screwed? Will it be enough taxpayers to subsidize Gen X's social security in retirement? Yeah, this intergenerational thing is a really interesting topic. I've talked about the Bank of Mum and Dad in a few posts, and that basically says that people with properties are actually taking money out of those properties and giving it to the kids so that they can buy. That it's part of the intergenerational thing. I get a lot of negativity from younger households who are trying to get into the property market. They've already got debt from student days. They're looking at the very low interest rates on deposits. They're looking at the massively high home prices and saying, are we ever going to get into the market? My observation is, I think I put a post up the other day saying, is it a good time to buy or sell? Well, you know, maybe it's not a fantastic time to buy now, because effectively I think prices will slide further. If you've already got a property and you need to sell, one property is worth one property. So effectively, if you buy and sell at the same time, wherever the market is, you don't actually miss out too badly. But I think if, depending on the type of person that you are and where you are in that cycle. But I do think there is an intergenerational injustice gone on here, and the baby boomers and, you know, some of the older generations have sat on this massive amount of spurious wealth. If it all goes pop, we'll see where that takes us. Okay, Lewis said, thoughts on New Zealand housing market, nature of is somewhat different to ours. Yes, I agree. I follow the New Zealand market because of, it's really interesting to see what the Reserve Bank in New Zealand has done or not done. The recent moves seem a bit weird to me, where they've sort of started to loosen some of the taps a little bit. They've got high migration, of course, there. They've got very high concentrations in Auckland. And it really isn't Auckland versus the rest. But they do have some higher controls on loan-to-income and loan-to-value ratios than we have here. But I think the New Zealand market is in for a bumpy ride in the month ahead. And somebody said, syphilis, re-student debt, at least we're not America. Yep. Okay, what is a comfortable loan-to-value in the long term? Interesting question. Okay, so when I was a banker in my youth, many years ago, right, I used to do loans based on an 80% maximum, so a 20% deposit, so a loan to value of 80 to 20, and on a ratio of income of three times the first income plus one times the second income. That would be the max I would do, and that was actually a good rule of thumb. It allowed people some wriggle room and some protection. The thing about equity in property, right, is as it goes up, you create this paper equity pool that you've got. So if you've got a loan to value ratio of 75 to 25, so you've got, in theory, 25% of value. If prices fall, you lose that, right? And that's the thing that people don't get. It's the banks who win, because effectively you lose that 25%, not the banks. The banks don't share it with you. So if prices drop 20%, you lose the 20%, and that's the point. So I think 20% is a really good rule of thumb, and above that, I think you're in awkward territory. Right, well, it's pretty much 9:15, so I want to say thank you very much to you all for taking the time to spend it with me. I've really appreciated all the comments, and it's been really interesting seeing some of those questions. I could clearly go on, and I won't go on now because I'm running out of steam. So thank you so much for spending the time with me. I will put this up hopefully as a live stream in its entirety. I'm also going to post an edited version on the podcast channel that I'm also running now. And tell me, would you like this again next month, next week? You know, if you're interested in a repeat performance, then I'm happy to do it. So thank you, one and all. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, signing off.